Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
It was kind of a sad moment at the Masters, or maybe a nostalgic moment as Vern Lundquist, in a very emotional farewell, signed off on his last Masters broadcast. Now, I was asked today in the Monday mailbag about broadcasters in general. Why aren't we creating more broadcasters? Who are some of the good young broadcasters in the game today? And I've got some theories on maybe why we don't have kind of the stable of broadcasters of yesteryear. Jim Nantz, Al Michaels, Bob Costas, Lundquist. You know, when you look at the history of really good television play-by-play broadcasters, you often find that there are radio broadcasters who graduated into television. Our next guest falls in that category. Started his broadcasting career on Laker Broadcasting in Lake Oswego, calling all the affluent kids of Lake Oswego as they played in a bunch of sporting events. Then he went to the University of Oregon, where he had an opportunity to be part of their broadcasts in that program there. And then he found his way to this radio show, and in fact was sitting in the very seat that Stephen Vaughn is sitting in today. And now is the voice of American soccer, Fox on MLS, or MLS on Fox. John Strong, broadcaster joining us. I want to talk about what makes a good play-by-play broadcaster and whether or not television is doing a good job bringing along broadcasters these days. John Strong joining us now to kick it around. Let me punch him up here. John Strong is with us. How are you, man?
Affluent a necessary modifier there? Like, is that relevant, or do you just felt like taking a dig? What does that mean?
I can't just have a normal intro. I have to barb or dig or a little bit, and I'm sure everybody not in Lake Oswego nodded with approval as I said
that. Don't
worry,
everyone in Lake Oswego. I started laughing out loud. It was good you didn't have me punched up then.
Well, let's talk about broadcasting. First of all, Vern Lundquist, do you have thoughts on Vern? I mean, he started off, got a start in radio. He was a Dallas Cowboys play-by-play broadcaster. Look at him now, 40 Masters in a row, Tiger Woods waxing about like how he grew up listening to Vern. What did you make of sort of the sign-off of Vern Lundquist? And by the way, John Sterling with the Yankees hanging it up today.
Oh, really? I didn't see that. I mean, that's so there's a couple things going on here. You're seeing some high-profile guys, and yet few of them are really retiring wholesale. Like, you know, Jim Nantz isn't doing March Madness anymore, just doing NFL and the Masters. Al Michaels, as an example, where NBC said, hey, we want to hand the torch over to Mike Tirico. Al Michaels is still doing Amazon Thursday Night Football. Bob Costas, so I know you mentioned, you know, they handed the torch a while ago. That was as much Costas as it was NBC. He's still calling baseball on MLB Network. And so you have seen situations kind of like Vern Lundquist where, you know, he retired from SEC on CBS a few years ago, but they let him keep, you know, his same tower at the Masters, which I think is nice. And I like that he had the opportunity to say goodbye on his terms. That does not always happen. That's one of those big early John Canzano lessons, is that, you know, you don't always get to call your own shot. It's not always on your terms when you're asked to go. So I thought it was really cool, and it's befitting sort of how CBS operates, and I think what makes the Masters great is the history and that tradition that they gave him that opportunity. But yeah, I wasn't surprised to see it pop up in your mailbag, just from the standpoint that, you know, it's like movies, it's like music, it's like when a Jimmy Buffett passes away. There's that pang of nostalgia, because those are the voices that we grew up on. And to see them retiring, stepping away, passing away in certain instances, yeah, it makes you feel old sometimes, and it sort of longs for the day of, you know, sitting in the living room on the couch or on the floor listening to that voice watching on television, that I also don't know that that really exists in the same way anymore, because even for a big game, are we really listening to the announcer in the way we would have 20 years ago, or are we scrolling on our phones, or do we have a second screen experience? Some of it is also, I think, a product of just an era when sports announcers, kind of like network news anchors, really captivated the attention of people, and you knew who they were, you knew their voice, you knew their face, and anymore, that era is kind of ending. And so it is interesting to see the reaction, and then to see your point, some of which I agree with, some of which I disagree with, about sort of what's the future, what's the next generation to you know, fill the shoes left by guys like Lundqvist.
Let's have that conversation, because I find myself, I am a play-by-play person. I grew up listening to play-by-play and love baseball play-by-play in particular, but I have just noticed maybe radio stations are not as into, you know, doing play-by-play as they once were. And by that, I mean sometimes, you know, you're getting a simulcast with a TV broadcast, or you're getting maybe a broadcaster who's an employee of the university, or is just somebody who has other duties within the athletic department at a school doing some of the lower-level sports. And I kind of wonder if we're doing a good job anymore cultivating those broadcasters. Can you speak to that point? I mean, you came up in the radio world, and now you're on TV, but what do you see? Do you see a commitment from radio to developing young broadcasters?
There's a couple things there, because, first of all, when you talk about radio, the radio business is kind of a mess as compared to what it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. There's just so much crunch financially. And, you know, global behemoth consolidation is a part of it. Losing market share to other forms of entertainment is a part of it. There are simply put fewer radio jobs available. And not even necessarily calling games, but even just having an actual radio station that employs actual human beings to tell the news or to give sports updates or to host a show or whatever. There's just so much less of that than there once was. You also have it doesn't mean that there's fewer opportunities. It just so much of it now with streaming on the internet, there's tons of play-by-play opportunities, but you have video to go along with it. And so many young broadcasters are never really in a scenario where they're calling a game that the listener at home cannot see. It's a totally different skill set. And I learned things that are very relevant to how I call games and work games now. Yes, by calling games on the actual radio, not a web stream with video, but also just doing the job there with you. Those were all very relevant skill sets. And because of those two factors, those opportunities don't exist as much anymore. And the other interesting thing is that as much as we talk about in sports, there's so much money and there's these bajillions of dollars, and that's where you're getting the market forces that leads to conference consolidation and things like that. The actual reality on the ground outside of the top levels is way worse. You know, athletic departments that aren't at the very tippy top of the food chain are seeing their budget squeezed considerably. Look at what's happened with minor league baseball and how many teams have just gone out of business very intentionally, and they've tried to contract the amount of minor league baseball teams there are, which has historically been such an important breeding ground for young broadcasters. And then you're exactly right, anymore being asked to, if you look at most minor league baseball broadcasters, they are very often head of marketing, head of communications, head of PR, maybe the digital team reporter. They're doing 14 different things. And so it can be hard to have the same attention to your craft, let alone the age-old problem of who are you getting feedback from? Where are you getting that feedback? Do people have time to sit there and listen to your demo reel and actually give you some pointers, which is something I try really hard to do for a lot of young broadcasters, anyone that'll ask, really, because I benefited from that. I was sort of the edge of the generation that was just getting into streaming, but still had some of the old, somewhat more analog ways of doing business that I was able to benefit immensely from getting coaching, getting feedback, working on the radio. So there's a bunch of factors that have changed it significantly, but I would still say there are still some tremendous young broadcasters out there, but there are also a lot of forces around them that are maybe either keeping them from developing a classical skill set or sometimes just keeping them from yet being noticed in quite the same way as a Vern Lundqvist or an Al Michaels or a Jim Nantz.
John Strong, play-by-play broadcaster, the lead play-by-play voice for MLS on Fox. You've seen him on the Timbers and heard him on the Timbers over the years, and also on the World Cup stage. Strong, I get that Tom Brady moves the needle. I understand why Fox wants Tony Romo, or you know, somebody wants Greg Olson. You know, there's an audience for such things. Have we pivoted in the industry to valuing sort of the celebrity analyst over the play-by-play guy, or has that always been a thing?
No, it's definitely shifted that way. I think some of that, again, comes from sort of a classical baseball era where Vin Scully didn't need an analyst. Red Barber didn't need an analyst. You know, Kurt Gowdy was Kurt Gowdy. He was the guy, regardless of who was next to him. And you absolutely saw a shift over time. Doesn't mean there weren't terrific analysts, but, you know, for instance, John Madden was the one that changed it all. And when John Madden got his contract to move from CBS to Fox, which was a bigger contract than any player had at the time a quarter century ago, that's when it started to change. And I would imagine only so many people could name who the other lead network NFL analyst was at the same time the man was becoming a big star. Merlin Olsen at NBC, who I thought was terrific with Dick Enberg, who I always loved, but he was not anywhere near as big a celebrity in a way that Mad was. And so now, to your point, you're absolutely right that there's a lot of value seen in that. And I think one of the times I came on recently, we talked about Tony Romo and the amount of money given to him and how he's very much became the star of that and not necessarily Jim Nance. And the way that Tom Brady has come in, you know, it was actually Troy Aikman, it was his move that precipitated the dominoes falling that led to Joe Buck joining him at ESPN and big changes for us at Fox. And I do think there is an element of, it's always going to be the case that the ex-professional athlete is more well-known on the desk than the host or in the booth than the play-by-play announcer, because you've built up a level of celebrity being that athlete. And I think we've also seen, a change to somewhat more of a mindset of the play-by-play guy is not the star that he once was. Now, should the play-by-play guy be the star anyway? To a certain extent, if you're calling a game on TV, well, everyone can see what you're talking about anyway. So your job is half done for you. I would also argue as well that classic journalist mentality and philosophy that the news anchor shouldn't be the star. The news should be the star. And being able to have the analyst there, especially on television, it's much more of an analyst medium than a play-by-play medium anyway. So I don't have a huge problem with it. But that's where, again, I disagree a little bit with the notion of there's no good young broadcasters. I think there's a terrific amount of good young broadcasters. I think it's one of the things that my network has done very intentionally is invest in a lot of terrific young broadcasters, all kind of around my age, you know, guys in their mid to late 30s. It's just that they're inevitably getting overshadowed a bit by the big-time analysts next to them. But also, as I said earlier, I just think we don't necessarily pay as much attention anymore to who the play-by-play guy is and what he or she is saying, because not just the person next to them maybe is more well-known, but how much of us really anymore watch a sporting event and it's the only thing we're doing, it's the only thing we're thinking about, and we're totally focused on what the announcers are saying? Way less than we would have a generation ago.
I'm thinking a lot about, you know, guys like Mike Parker at Oregon State and certainly Jerry Allen at Oregon, and I wonder who's coming behind them. And we've had this conversation in the newspaper world over the years. Like, I can remember Bill Plachke of the LA Times, Tim Kawakami, who was at the Mercury News. I was working with him at the time, and Kawakami would say, he says, John, no one's coming behind us. There's no columnist coming behind us. We're not cultivating a columnist. Are the universities turning out broadcasters that can slide into that Jerry Allen, Mike Parker role? Or because those guys don't leave for decades, is that even a thing anymore?
Some of it is both of those things, and I would say to Plachke's point, it's sort of a paradox, because how would you have a big-name columnist in the wings? How would they have become a big name? The incumbent's the big name. When are you going to get that opportunity? You know, and so some of it, this is where I think a lot of teams and schools and networks fall into a trap of, wanting to have an established name immediately. Well, that means you're not going to give someone the opportunity to grow in the role. You know, I hugely benefited from the fact that when I was hired at NBC and at Fox, they both intentionally said, we want someone that is young, that is unproven, but that we can sort of grow and cultivate over time. It was less a mentality of what had been the case before, where let's get someone that is an established voice already. I see teams do this all the time, is they would rather hire someone. Think of it like coaches, right? Do you feel more comfortable with your favorite team hiring a coach? Oh, I know that guy. He's coached six other teams, which means he's been fired at six other teams. Would you feel more comfortable with that or with the assistant coach who's the young guy being given his first opportunity? I don't know about that. First-time head coach, that sounds dicey. Well, where else is he going to get that experience? But it's absolutely something that I would say, and I've made my feelings known to some people down in Eugene, and if Rob Mullins is listening, I'm happy to let him know that now. You know, Jerry Allen has deserved the right to call his shot. Whenever he feels it's his time is when his time should be, because he's meant so much to so many people for such a long time. But I will scream to the high heavens that I do not, and I would say the same through Oregon State, I would not want to see them just go out and hire someone who's an established, polished, professional veteran broadcaster who has no actual connection to the school, to the fan base. And yeah, at a certain point, it's good to have fresh blood and an outside perspective. But I think that's one of the things you lose, is you lose the connection that does exist between fans and their team. When you kind of bring someone in that doesn't have any connection, doesn't mean they can't build it. I mean, that's what Brian Wheeler did in Portland. He was the outside guy when Sean Lee left. That was a no-win scenario. He became the voice of the Blazers over time. He built that connection up and was sort of the rare example of that working. But I feel strongly that you're going to have longer-term success investing in someone and letting them make mistakes. The Timbers did that with me. Merritt Paulson did that with me. I was way too young to be given that opportunity with the Timbers in 2011. And I cringe when I watch those old broadcasts because I'm like, man, I was not ready for that. But they were willing to take their lumps with me because they saw something in the future. And I think that is, it's a risky thing to do. It's a dangerous thing to do in the way that we view life and business now. But it's like anything else. You have to be willing to take that risk and to sort of ride the bumps early on to create anything great down the road.
Also, refresh my memory. Who was your first agent? Who negotiated that first Timbers deal?
Boy, did that cause ripples around the organization when they found out that the local sports columnist was involved in the contract negotiations. Man alive.
Well, I had to protect my guy, okay? I knew all the parties.
Your biggest contribution was getting me, instead of two season tickets, I think I got four,
yeah,
as I recall.
That's 100% increase over what you were getting.
That's
so
true. And then when you were no longer my agent, I went back down to two. So you know what?
It was a little bit like when Ben Affleck went in there to negotiate on behalf of Matt Damon. Reminded me of that scene. John Strong.
That will be a whole chapter in the book. The statute of limitations on some of those stories has yet to expire, but that'll be like chapter four in the book.
John Strong is with us, Fox broadcaster, MLS. All right, look, so you know, you're the masters. You've got Nance, who's kind of still dabbling. Lundqvist is, you know, saying goodbye. And what do they do? What do they, you know, what do events do? What does a NCAA tournament on CBS do? And, you know, as they try to transition a new voice, is it that big a deal? Because I can remember back in the day watching Monday Night Football, and it was Howard Cosell, and it was Dandy Don, and it was Frank Gifford, and then they started messing with the rotation, and it wasn't quite the same. You know, they had Dennis Miller in there for a while, and you know, what does the Masters do?
It's funny because I would invite people, when you think about in the 70s and the 80s sports broadcasting, and you think about how good it was then, why isn't it good now? Why isn't it good now like it was then? All those old broadcasts, by the way, are on YouTube, and I find myself sometimes watching back old sports broadcasts because I find it interesting because I'm a nerd that way. But I would invite people sometimes to actually listen back to some of those Monday Night Football telecasts with Howard Cosell, you know, and Frank Gifford and those guys. It actually isn't great. They make a ton of mistakes. There are moments where it's clear they haven't rehearsed. It's kind of all over the shop. As compared to now, the types of things and the way that they do it, it's not even necessarily a technological thing. there's just a polish to it now that didn't exist then, which is, I think, really fascinating. But we, of course, view it through rose-tinted glasses. I think the Masters is different than anything else in so many ways, right? You know, and listen, for Vern Lundquist, he was on one tower on one hole. I think it'll be very different when Jim Nantz steps aside, because the Masters kind of has to have a sort of, you know, older voice, calmer voice. That's what golf is. That's what Masters is, the Masters is. But it's going to be a massive challenge because there are just certain voices and certain broadcasters that become so identified over time with an event, it's almost impossible to think of replacing them. And I think that's going to be, when Jim Nantz does retire, the challenge CBS and the Masters are going to find themselves in. But to the same point, would you have said that the very first time that Jim Nantz did it? You have to grow that over time. And, you know, I think one of the great examples is, at my network, you know, Joe Buck did the World Series for a quarter century. There's an entire generation of people who have grown up as baseball fans only knowing Joe Buck called the World Series. Well, then he leaves for ESPN, and here comes Joe Davis. Well, Joe Davis has the opportunity to do the exact same thing. And so while it's easy to say, oh, I miss Joe Buck now, in 10, 15, 20 years, Joe Davis gets to that level. And so I think there is also there has to be, as I said, that willingness to sort of take that risk and hand it to someone new, even though you know it's not going to be as good. And then the dangerous temptation you fall into, Joe Buck has talked about this, that when he got the gig taking over for Pat Summerall, he spent his first 5-10 years trying to do a Pat Summerall impersonation. And you can't do that. You have to be different, even though, particularly in this day, and it was true in the newspaper 20 years ago, there were always media critics, now it's online. All you're going to have is people saying, this new person isn't as good, they don't do it the way that the old guy did, you know, whatever network it is has made a mistake. Again, we want that instant success. We want that instant vindication. It's not going to happen. It's where I do think it was unique that Ian Eagle came in, and it's different because Ian Eagle is so well-known and so popular. And I don't think there was necessarily a sense of, like, this is wrong or bad when he was leading March Madness and calling the Final Four, because he's so terrific at what he does. So that was kind of a different situation. But it is a really hard thing sometimes to replace the shoes of a legend in whatever kind of a role that is. But that's where I scream and yell to people, you can't make that snap judgment, because that person who has been replaced, they weren't that legend when they first started. It builds over time. And some of what makes a broadcaster like Vern Lundquist great, more than anything else, is the fact that they were on the air for 20, 25, 30 years. It's the longevity sometimes, far more so than the actual skill or the way they call certain moments, that leads to their popularity. And that's something I try to tell young broadcasters all the time. The easier thing to do is to go viral, to get a bunch of likes and retweets, and to sort of have that 15 minutes of where you're on top. The more difficult thing to do is to build a body of work that is seen as somewhat more timeless, and that you can keep the job for a very long time, and that even though you're naturally going to be rougher at the beginning than the end, there's still a sense of being able to listen back to old broadcasts, yes, and it still sounds good. That's the more difficult thing to do, and that to me is much more a measure of greatness, is having that longevity and having people want to welcome you into their living room, or increasingly into their AirPods and their phone, every single day over a period of years.
John Strong with us, Fox soccer broadcaster. Look, you hit on something there, because I was thinking about myself as a writer in newspapers. I had tremendous growth, particularly right around my second, third stop early in my career. I was getting a lot of reps. I would cringe if anybody went back and read what I was writing, just like your original radio broadcasts. And, you know, it's terrible, but I was improving. I sort of hit a stage, maybe at the last paper I was at, where I wasn't, like, I was looking around and I was the most experienced person, right? And I didn't have a mentor. And I was going, okay, how do I get better? And I really had to, as I departed and went on my own, seek out veteran writing coaches and people and involve them in my new project and say, hey, I need that feedback. I need that growth. And it's working, so I'm getting it again. So how do you at Fox get that? Do they have you working with mentors, getting feedback? And how do you know what feedback to take, not to take?
And that's sometimes the most dangerous and the most difficult thing, is knowing what advice to listen to. And I'll absolutely say that's a challenge for me right now, because I've gotten to a point that, okay, I'm established enough, and I've been doing it for, you know, a decade plus now at a national level, and it's easy to kind of get complacent, and it's easy for me to sit here like, yeah, I kind of know what I'm doing, and that's really, really, really dangerous, and that's where broadcasters get themselves in trouble. It's where anyone gets themselves in trouble. When you think you have it figured out, that's when you're at your most vulnerable to really having. One of my favorite concepts ever from a coach was Nate McMillan when he coached the Blazers, and he would talk about slippage. To him, that was when you're in a stretch of a season where you're playing more games and then you're having practices, and the days in between are just recovery. We're not working on our game on the practice court. We're just trying to recover physically for the next game. That's when the bad habits start to creep in. That's when the slippage occurs. And it's something that I think about a lot. It's something I've talked with my wife, Nicole, about a lot. It's something I talk with my partner, Stu Holden, about all the time. Is, A, I think you're oftentimes your best self-critic if you're doing it right. And I will listen to I'll listen to 2018 World Cup final, and I'll kind of cringe at things I wish I could have done better then. But even the last World Cup final, I wish I missed on that one. I wish I could do that better. There's always that process of self-improvement, but it's also something that I will say I could definitely do a better job of, is seeking out producers that I've had, other people in the business, and say, hey, can you just really carve me up here? Like, really carve me up with this tape and tell me what I'm doing wrong. And I would love to sit here and say, oh, but I'm so busy and the kids and this. I think sometimes, too, it comes back to an insecurity that is really we all kind of have. And maybe it's easier when you're younger because you know that you need to get better and you're desperate to, and it's harder on the other end to still seek that out because, again, the easier thing is to kind of sit there and be like, yeah, no, I know what I'm doing. That's a very dangerous place to be. And that's, you know, for me, the most important thing I'll do this year is this summer. And Copa America. That'll be the biggest platform we have. It'll be the biggest spotlight. That's when I have to deliver at my best. And we're building up to that now. And so, yeah, what am I doing? And I'm sort of asking this rhetorically out loud to myself. What am I doing to make sure that I'm way better in the summer of 2024 than I was in the fall of 2022 or last summer? And that I will be better in 2025 than I am now. You need to cut that process. And I love the concept of, you know, there's no standing still. You're either getting better or getting worse. Mm-hmm. And it involves work. And it involves sort of having a brutal honesty with yourself, but being able to accept brutal honesty from other people, which can sometimes be the most difficult thing to do.
John Strong, you're the best. I love talking. I could geek out on this. We could do an hour on this. And I think, too, when you talk about people giving you feedback, the best are going to give you – they're not really going to carve you up. They're going to give you one or two things that you can really focus on. And then the next time they give you one or two things, and all of a sudden you look up and you're like, you know what, those are really good small tips to take with you.
What would you say? You listen every once in a while to me. What can I be doing better?
No, yeah, I think you have graduated beyond my capabilities. That's the issue for
that's
me.
That's code for I haven't watched a soccer game in 2 years. I got nothing to give
you. I'm your agent. I'm your agent. Of course I'm listening to you. Get out of here. Listen, I think you're great at what you do, and I think one of the fun things is I've watched you grow, right, as a broadcaster. And I think what I got early on was you were a radio guy who is transitioning to TV, and it's very different, isn't it? Like, you're on radio, you're painting a picture, and on television, you're laying back a little bit, aren't you?
Well, on radio, you're kind of on your own. Well, not kind of, you're totally on your own. And that was the biggest challenge that I struggled to understand going to television, is you're now part of a big team, and it's the equivalent of trying to turn an aircraft carrier. I can't just launch into a thought or a story. I have to make sure that my analyst, my producer, my director, our graphics BA, our tape room, our camera operators, everyone's got to be on the same page here for this to work. Otherwise, if director's doing one thing, if camera's doing one thing, if graphics are doing a different thing, if my analyst is making a separate point, then what am I even doing? And being able to understand how that teamwork has to work was a really big part of the transition for sure. But it is one of the coolest things for me, and I don't say this to brag about myself, but just to sell kind of the point that you were making, is when I do talk to young broadcasters and they sometimes will sheepishly say, like, I've grown up listening to you. And, like, you know, some of those things. And I when I can hear ways that I've influenced other broadcasters, that to me is like, you know what, shoot, like, all things being equal, this is pretty amazing that a kid that was just trying to get a chance, that was sort of freaking out about calling the 3A boys high school final in 2004, and now I'm in a position where, you know, other broadcasters in it have kind of grown up listening to me, and I can hear them kind of emulating things that I do. Those moments are neat. But as I say, you can't wallow in that too long. You got to stay sharp because they're all coming for your job.
There it is. John Strong, voice of American soccer. Thank you, John.
See you, bud. Always appreciate it.
There he goes. Stephen Vaughn, little known fact. I got that guy 100% increase in his contract with the Timbers. At least when it came to the tickets that they were offering him, I got him no more money. But I sat down like Ben Affleck and I said, listen, to give a play-by-play broadcaster two tickets when you have seats available is a slap in the face. So he got four out of the deal.
Love it. I know if I ever need an agent, you're the first guy I'm going to because I need extra tickets. That's the thing. I don't need money. I don't need anything else. I just need tickets. That's all I want.
I was not offended when John Strong hired a real agent went off to work for ESPN and Fox and other things.
But it's a good resume builder, though. Like, it's something you can be like, you know what? I was John Strong's agent. You know John Strong, the voice of American soccer? Yeah, that guy.
I'm good in those scenarios. I just, you know, I basically was advocating for my friend. All right, leave it here. We got Punch It Audio coming up. Steven's got the 5 at 5 today. No Anna today. You got the BFP.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.